It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker from Visalia with 2 years, Rita. Let's give it up for Rita.
I'm Rita Alcoholic. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I feel blessed and honored to be here tonight. Doesn't matter how many years I have, I always cry over everything, so I apologize in advance. But I just want to say welcome to the newcomers, because you guys are the most important people here in the room. I was one of you guys one of these days, 2 years ago, and if you want to stay sober, I advise you to get a sponsor, work the 12 steps, attend meetings, fellowship, and then after your 12 steps, get a sponsee. Your sponsee will change your life. Okay, so my sobriety date is June 10th, 2016. Some people say it's on Founders Day, but Founders Day ended up on the 9th this year, so I don't know what the deal is about that. This is a family disease. I have. I was raised by my stepfather and my mother, and they were all alcoholics. You know, when you're little and you don't know what's going on in your family, all you know is there's arguing, fighting, yelling, throwing things. In the beginning, I used to say I had a wonderful childhood. You know, we had the best. We had a swimming pool. We lived in a nice area. We went to school. Our parents worked. And then going back through my step work, I looked at it was very chaotic. A lot of yelling and screaming going on all the time. And, I loved my father. My father was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and he just passed away a couple weeks ago. So, you know, I'm still dealing with that. And my stepdad both passed away. My real dad passed away from alcoholism and drugs, and I was able to be by his side while he passed. But this is a family disease. Just knowing that I went through all that as a child, and bringing up all those memories when you work your step work, I can see this huge pattern of abuse, emotionally and mentally, and it set me up for the stage of my using and my drinking further down the road, but I didn't even know it. I got married. So a little story about my childhood, what it was like for me. I remember being about 4 or 5 years old, and every night before I used to go to bed, I used to walk into the living room, and I used to ask my mom, you know, my dad, you know, give me a hug and give me a kiss, because I loved them so much. And all I wanted to do was be loved and accepted. As a child, I think that's all we ever wanted, you know, just to be nurtured by our parents. And I know that as being a mother now, that they're so innocent, you know, and all they want is that love and that nurture. And my parents were not emotionally there for me at all. And I don't blame them. Before, I used to blame things on them, but now I don't. I understand that their parents raised them a certain way, and they didn't get the love and nurture from their parents. And it stemmed down from that. And I understand that today. And my parents did the best they could with the best of their ability. I was clothed. I went to school every day. I had food on the table. I had a nice house. And we had, my parents were there, not emotionally, but they were there physically. And I don't blame anything, my alcoholism on them, but I just understand it more now today. In middle school, when I started growing up and I went to middle school and elementary, I was like a chameleon. And all I wanted to do is be loved, because I didn't really know who I was. And I would do anything to fit in with any crowd. And so I decided to hang out with the skaters because I really didn't know who I was. I was still finding out who I liked. Just happened to meet my neighbors, and we were all into skating and all that stuff. So I started hanging out with the skaters. And, I got bullied a lot in middle school and high school. And now that I can look back, I just wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be Mexican, and I was the white girl on the block, and I never could be Mexican. But, me and my brother, we were these dark little white kids on the neighborhood, and so we blended right in with them. But my whole entire life, I wanted to be Mexican. Okay, and it didn't work because they always made fun of me. I always got made fun of, and my nickname in school was Giraffe because of my long neck, so they always made fun of me. And my friends, my best friends that I grew up with, would constantly make fun of me because their boyfriends would end up falling for me, and I would try to make myself look like a boy so I could look ugly because they would hate me for them liking me, and it made me feel horrible inside. Like, my mom don't like me, like them, they're your girlfriend. But I just wanted to be accepted so bad, and that's sad, but it is what it is. So in high school, I had no identity. In the early 90s, I was at Redwood High School, and gangs started popping off really bad. A lot of gangs from L.A. started coming around. I had, I was born and raised in Visalia, so I was raised around a lot of North Angeles. So when Southerners started coming into town, I started hanging out with whoever would accept me. So I had to hang out with my best friends that were Northerners and my other best friends that were Southerners. But I was the white girl, so I just thought I could hang out with anybody. And it just caused a lot of problems. I was, as soon as I turned 18, I went to jail. And the only reason why I wanted to be this badass person to go to jail is because I wanted to prove to everybody I wasn't a snitch. Don't ask me why. That is the stupidest decision I've ever made in my life, and I've regretted it my whole entire life. But when I was 18, I ended up in jail, and then when I was in jail, I didn't want to tell. My mother was a correction officer, so she was never there for us. Me and my brother, we just ran crazy, but we. I was just terrified of my mother, but I don't know how I ended up in jail, always in trouble all the time. And then I decided, but she told me one thing. She's like, do not get pregnant. Whatever you do, just do not get pregnant. Well, when I went to jail, I called her and I said, guess what? I'm pregnant also. And, it just the chaos that I put my family through. It happened to be that I ended up marrying that person, and we had three more children. We were married for 14 years, and the guy that I decided to marry was a drug dealer. So that ended up on another whirlwind of drama, chaos, and total chaos. I thought it was cool to have the bail bonds guy and the lawyer on speed dial. That's what my life was about. I don't know why the perception of that, I thought I was cool. And now looking back and how stupid that was. And, being married to him for 14 years was, I physically got beat by him. I was not allowed to go anywhere. But I did raise our three boys the way I wanted to raise them. And today they're wonderful boys. They're 22, 19, and 18. And two of them are in the military, and one will be heading to the military hopefully in a couple months. So I did amazing. It wasn't me that did it. It was all God. Because if three boys get raised by an alcoholic mom and a gangbanger dad, you can only imagine chaos would have come out of that. only by the grace of God, those three boys wanted nothing to do with their mom or dad. They said that gangs are stupid and drugs and alcohol are even stupider. They're all, we don't want to end up like our mom and we don't want to end up like our dad. So I don't understand. I mean, it was just amazing. I'm blown away by my children. And they laugh at me all the time, you know, that, you know, I'm in recovery or whatever. I asked them if they wanted to come tonight, and they told me absolutely not, because they were going to be put on the spot and I was going to pinpoint them out of the whole crowd. And they said they did not want to come because they didn't want me to mention that they were in the crowd. And so that's funny. But anyways, after I was married for 14 years, I never drank, or I never used drugs, I never did anything. And I would drink a Smirnoff every 2 years, and it made me too tipsy that I didn't like it. I liked to be in control and in the situation. And I was just the caretaker, so I took care of everything, and I had to be busy, and I had to do this. You know, by the time I turned 31, when my husband left me, I decided, you know, he likes to go out and party. I'm going to find out what this partying life is all about. I'm going to go out and party. I was like, you know what? I deserve it. I've raised my children. I have a house, a car. I have a career. I want to go out and party. I had no clue, absolutely no clue. This is how naive I was, that you can become an alcoholic or drug addict. I started drinking margaritas every day. And I apologize in advance. I know this is an AA meeting, but other substances are my issue too. But alcohol is the main culprit in my story. When I turned 31, I started drinking margaritas every day, all day long, and break, lunch, work. As soon as I drove home, I was driving to daycare to pick up my kids, drunk off my ass. And as soon as I blew up, I was wearing a size 14 pants, and I've never seen myself so huge, and I got upset at that. And a girlfriend of mine introduced me to meth, and it took off from there. And never knew that you can become a drug addict, but I got hooked, and I got hooked quick. 4 years, as soon as I hit 31 and I started drinking and using, I lost my house, I lost my cars. But during that time, I blamed everything on my divorce, that he left me. So he left me with no money. So I blamed losing my house, my cars, my kids, everything. I didn't blame it. I couldn't pinpoint it. I didn't blame anything on my alcoholism or my drug use. I blamed none of it. So I hid under that. So I told everybody, oh, I'm a functioning alcoholic. I'm a functioning alcoholic. I still work. I still have my job. Who cares? I lost my house. And then the stock market crashed, so I lost everything, and I had to move back in with my mother. I started all over. I was still trying to do a functioning alcoholic and a functioning drug addict between those 3 years before I met my second husband. My second husband was a major alcoholic, and he just made it even. It lit my alcoholism on fire. I went off on a whirlwind, and the thing is, it got covered up over, he's an alcoholic, he uses cocaine, he does that, he does this, when I'm in the back doing something else, and I'm sitting there saying, oh, it's not as bad, because look at him, he's a hot mess. And it was horrible. You know, I love that man. He's an amazing guy. But when we got married, we were 3 years into our relationship, and it was total chaos. Windows were being kicked out. People were getting left on the side of the road. It was just insane intense. And we made so much money, by Monday, we were asking to borrow $20 for gas. And it was total insanity. But you know what? On the day of my wedding, my perfect white wedding and beautiful out in the cotton fields, it was perfect. The wedding I always dreamed of. I'm walking down the aisle thinking, I should not be marrying this man. We don't even like each other. And I'm sitting there like, we hate each other. We don't even like it. We can't even drink around each other because we irritate the crap out of each other. And we, you know, it's just like, I pick at him, he's a piece of crap, and he picks at me thinking I'm a controlling freak and I can't stand, you know, it was a crazy, crazy incident. But we only stayed married for 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, in 2013, my alcoholism and addiction got so bad that my kids were like, "What's going on with you? You're just so acting so weird." The thing is, I hid out in the garage all the time and by the tool bench, all day long, all night long. As soon as I got home, I made dinner, then I was in the garage. And I don't think everybody just did their own thing. They never thought to think, "Well, where's mom at?" In the garage by the tool bench, you know, just miserable. I don't know what I was doing, but you know, I was that way. And you know what? When I at the end of our marriage on New Year's 2012, my husband caught me doing drugs. And I was just so out of it. I was gone. I had pretty much done everything. Every drug that you could put in front of me, I would have done. And he caught me, and he looked at me, and I told him, I need to go to rehab. And he's like, "I can't believe you've been lying to me this whole time." And I go, "Yeah, I'm pretty bad. I'm really, really bad right now." And it was a whole night of partying for New Year's. And I told him, "Something's wrong with me because I feel like killing myself." And from that instant, I was introduced to rehab. 3 days later, I was taken, probably involuntarily, but I was taken away, and I was taken up to Utah for my first rehab, and I got to spend 30 days there, and it was in a beautiful, amazing place. I was there for 30 days, and when I walked into rehab, I sat down there, and I go, "I feel like I'm in jail right now. Like, I cannot believe I might have jumped the gun, and I might have told them something that they shouldn't have known. Like, maybe I'm not an alcoholic or drug addict. We better make sure, because I just put myself in a location where I'm 4.5 miles from the nearest gas station, and there's nowhere to go." Like, people were leaving this rehab, and I'm like, "Where are they going? Because I want to go with them. Like, they're going to, and there's cows and coyotes down the street. Like, we're all going to get murdered out here one of these days." Like, I was terrified because we were out in the middle of nowhere. It was a beautiful place on the side of a hill, but we were absolutely nowhere. And we couldn't leave that place if we wanted to. And so I ended up finishing that place. I learned a lot. I learned that my marriage was a joke, and they had me realize and write down what was so good about the marriage that I was in. And by the end of that rehab, I was telling them, "How do I get out of the divorce? How do I get out of it? What do? I don't want to go home to them." And yeah, it was bad. But I ended up relapsing like usual. My story is, I relapsed in 6 years. I have gone and come in and out of these doors 8 different times. I have done 6 different detoxes. And all those situations was because I had constant reservations, and I sure I wasn't done with using and drinking yet. I just needed to make sure that I was done to do this for the rest of my life. Because when I came in the doors, I thought, I can't stop drinking for the rest of my life. Like, who wants to do that? Like, I want to go out and have a glass of wine. I want to go out and have fun. I want to go to the bars. You know what? But for me, that becomes step one. Step one is powerlessness and unimaginability. I've done step one probably 6 or 8 times, and I still could not understand it. I used to tell my sponsors, and by the way, I've had 5 different sponsors, and all of them, I blamed all my relapses on them. And I know that's not the way you're supposed to do things. But my step work, I realize I take responsibility for nothing. I blame all my faults on everybody else. That just makes me sleep at night. But now I learn my part of the road, you know. Step one is powerless and unmanageability. I know that the first drink or that first hit takes me off on another run, and I have no idea when I'm going to stop. I tell my sponsees, I imagine like a little baby dragon inside, and it's sleeping right now. And right now, I'm not feeding it with any alcohol or drugs, but it's sleeping. As soon as I inject something into my body, that dragon awakes and it takes over my whole body, and it doesn't stop until I don't even know. So either I'm dead or in a hospital or I'm in jail. And that's the scary part. That's what scares me, is I don't know where I'm going to end up at. The unmanageability is my last run. I have a family, you know, that we have a family business and all that stuff, and you know, I had some responsibilities. They took a lot of it away from me because I was, you know, they knew that I was not, I was drinking and using. So I had places to go, people that would take me in. At my last run, nobody wanted to answer the phone. Nobody would open the door for me. I tell a joke that I went over to my mom's house. My brother and my mom are in recovery, but my brother tells my mom, "You better stop giving her money, stop giving her a place to stay, stop doing this." And I go, "He gave me up. How could he do that to me? I really need my mom. My mom would enable me till the day I die." I call my mom and I go over there, and she cracks open the door, and I'm like, "Let me in." Like, I hold my family hostage. I'm mean. Like, my mother, I tell her what to do. And I just feel, like, horrible because I've done a lot of step work on it. But I just tell her, "What? Why don't you open the door? What are you doing?" And she's all like, "No, Steve called me, and you are not allowed to come in this house." And I go, "Excuse me?" I was like, I go, "But I'm hungry and I need to eat, or I need some gas money to go somewhere." And she goes, "Well, how'd you get here?" I'm all, "But I drove over here on empty, so I need." She's all, "That's your fault. You shouldn't have came over here. I didn't answer my phone, so don't come over here." And I go, "But I'm hungry, Mom. I need some food. I really am." And then me, the victim, the professional victim that I am, I go, I start crying, and I want her to make feel sorry for me. And she goes, "Hold on, just wait a minute." She shuts the door, doesn't let me in, and I'm crying at the doorstep. She comes out with the bag, and it's full of canned food. And I go, "But I don't even have a can opener. I don't know how I'm supposed to eat this food." And so she's like, "I don't know, figure it out." So that was the end of that. After that, I never called my mom anymore. I would stay over people that were in my addiction. I stayed over their houses. You know, my last run ended up me sitting in a house, staring at a wall, just rocking back and forth, thinking, "I'm going to die here. I'm going to die. This is it." I started seeing demons. I started, you know, I just rather take my own life, but I didn't have the balls to, but in order to live anymore. Every day I woke up, I was sick. I was ill. I was hungry. That was a scary place for me to be. But that is my step one. That is my unmanageability. And then on top of it, I ended up living out of the backseat of my car. And I thought it was cool to open my trunk and to be like, "Yeah, there's my underwear, there's my bras, there's my pants, you know, my pants and my shirts, all nice folded. I still got it. I still got it together. I don't need to call anybody. I haven't hit rock bottom yet. I'm not in the gutter yet. I still got my car and all my clothes laid out right here." And, you know, I don't know what that is, but that's the bottom, you know, that. And you know what? When I told them that, I go, they said, "No, you could still lose your car and end up by the dumpster." And I was like, that'll never happen to me. So that my last run, that's how bad it was. But that helps me understand step one as powerlessness. Powerlessness is, and there's three points. It's the obsession, the craving, and the spiritual. The obsession is when that I obsess over something, or something triggers me, or I go by an old house or somewhere I used to kick it at. That obsession comes over me, thinking maybe I could do it one more time. Maybe I could do it one more time. No, it's not. It's the obsession. That's when I get on my hands and I start praying and say, "God, relieve me of the obsession. Relieve me of the obsession." He does it because, you know what? It's just a feeling. It only lasts for a couple minutes. I sit on my hands, and by the next couple hours, it's gone. Then the second one is the craving. The craving is once you drink that first drink, once you take that first hit, that craving comes on. That's when that dragon awakes, and I don't know where I'm going to end. And the third one is your spiritual. That spirit, that connection to God is broken after you've taken that first drink, that first hit. So when you identify those three things, I can understand things more. Because if you just tell me a bunch of stuff, I'm not going to realize it unless it's broken down for me. And that's just the way I have to learn today. Step two is came to believe a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. So before, when I did step two, I was told that, do you understand that you're insane right now and that you are going to become sane? So I go, step two, after I've done it, I can restore myself to sanity, but I have to believe that something bigger than myself can restore me. It can't be me taking full control over everything. I have to let go and let God, and I have to believe that something bigger than me is out there and can restore me, which I choose to call as my higher power. Step three is the deal breaker for me. When you make that decision, because that's something you have to do, or you want to do, or I become willing to do, is I made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What it is my alcoholism and my drug addictions right here, I hand it over to Him and let Him have it. And I do not take it back. Because when I know that I take it back, it's because I'm irritated, I'm angry, I'm mad, and I hate everybody, and I'm trying to control situations. When I let Him go, I let the outcome up to Him. And whatever outcome it comes, it's going to be amazing. And if it's not the outcome that I choose to have it, I can trust my higher power that whatever situation it is, it's going to be beautiful at the end of the road. Whatever I can go through, it's going to be beautiful because I know that He's never going to let me down. And when I hand it over, I give it to Him. I don't take it back, because once you take it back, you can tell you're irritated, you're discontent, you're angry all the time, and everybody upsets you. You know, your neighbor upsets you, your mom upsets you, your brother upsets you. So that's why I tell everybody to step three is amazing. It's His will. And so a lot of people that I know, like when they go to court and they're going to court, and I tell them, do step three over and over and over. Give it up to God and hand over your will to Him. Whatever that judge says, whatever they determine about your children, give it up to Him. And whatever outcome comes, and if it's not the one that you wanted, know that He has your best interest in that. Step four is made a searching and fearless moral inventory. This step right here is a game changer. I always say, like, we have a bunch of weeds that are deep down inside. And what I tell my sponsees is we get down in there. We don't just pull the weeds out. We get in and we get the roots. We get the roots and we rip them out. And what it is making that list. The sex inventory and the ones that we still have resentments over. I remember back in the days, like, I can imagine what I was to say to my sponsor. I used to say, but my mom did this and my brother did this. They always do this. I blamed and my ex-husband. They wronged me. He abused me. And you know what? But I chose to be in those situations. I participated in stuff that I shouldn't have participated. So I draw the drama in because I got sucked in, but I participated in it. And you know what? I used to deal with a lot of guilt and shame for the way I treated my kids. In my alcoholism and my drug addiction, but today I don't. I can't change the past. The past is the past, and all I can do is know that I can, change the future, and know that it's God's will, not mine. And you know, I just love step four. It's just amazing. But the thing is. When you do step four, when I do it with my sponsees, I have them do it for like about a month so they can really sit on it and then dig deep. Because I know for me, it took me a while to get down to the stuff that I had suppressed for so many years. I'm 41 years old and I've been through a lot of drama, but there's a lot of people that I've had issues with that I suppressed for so many years that I can't even think of their names anymore. And on my fourth step, I put the neighbor next door or the boss that I used to work with that cussed me out one day. And it just made me realize what the patterns are, but then it also made me realize what was my part in that. You know, I wasn't a good employee. I used to come to work late every day, and then I'd sit there and just fall asleep at my desk. You know, I was not very productive. Of course, she would probably chew me out and put me in there and write me up for stuff. It's because, you know, and the way I acted. And so step four was a good one. And then step five, admitted to God and to ourselves the exact to another human being the exact natures of our wrong. That's when, you know, 4 and 5 is when you really need a sponsor, and to sit down and make that connection with somebody. I tell my sponsees when I meet with a new girl, like, let's build a house. Let's build the foundation first, but I want to build a good foundation with you. I'll tell you my story, my experience, strength, and hope, and I want you to tell me your experience, strength, and hope. Let's get to know each other, and let's build that foundation. Because the one thing I've learned in the past is that just hanging out with a girl and calling her my sponsor does not work. I'm all, yeah, she's my best friend, but she's also my sponsor. You know what? It doesn't, for me, that didn't work. And so that's what I do on step 5, the exact natures of our wrongs. When I told my sponsor all the stuff that I went through, my step 4 list on why I had resentments over these people, and that's when I got called out on the carpet. I don't like being told that I'm wrong or that I do, that I'm wrong in a situation that really, that hurts my ego and my pride. And that's another thing that kept me out for a long time, is that my ego and my pride and just the fear of myself kept me out a long time, and those had to be smashed. But I didn't know I had those. So when you identify those, I acknowledge them, and then I accept them, and then that's when I can change the situation. So when I was told, you know, that I was saying something, I was telling her my story, and then she turned around and she goes, "Do you really believe what's coming out of your mouth right now?" And I'm like, yes. By the end of those step 4 and step 5, I would leave her house crying, saying, "I'm never going back there. I hate her and I don't like her anymore." And eventually I would go back because I do love her. And the thing is, the next couple of days would be like, wow, I've experienced something I have never experienced. I had walls so high that nobody could break them or get past them. And, you know, she helped me break through those walls and experience something, because I became willing. I know on step 4 and step 5 or step 6, I stopped going to see my sponsor a couple weeks, and then she texted me this in big bold letters, "Be willing." And I will always remember that, because it made me afraid to do any more steps with her because of the situation I went through with step 4 and step 5, realizing, you know what, I'm believing my own bull crap and I should not. I need to give myself a break. I need to start breaking down these walls that have held me in my alcoholism for so long, and I'm tired of living miserable. I want some change, you know. And she helped me and baby stepped me and walked me through all that, and I'm forever grateful for that, because that just, I'm able to pass the message on and help other women because I became willing to keep on doing my own footwork, and that's just a miracle in itself. Step 6, when we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You know, my defects of character are, is that I'm a people pleaser. Comes from, you know, wanting to be accepted. I'm a people pleaser. I'm a caretaker. I love to take care of other people except myself. And I'm a master manipulator and a professional victim. I will only be your friend if you have something in return, if there are strings attached, or you got a big bank account, or you got a big wallet, then you're my friend. Or you drive a nice car, you're only my friend if you have something that I can get out of you. And then a victim is, don't you feel sorry for me? I used to be beaten by my ex-husband. Like, I know that I chose to be with him, and I chose to be in that relationship for 14 years and had the choice to get out of it, but don't you feel sorry for me? Gosh, I was abused. And that's when that professional victim comes in. I'm a victim of every circumstance. And once I identified my character defects, I can identify them, acknowledge them, accept them, and then I can change them. Step 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. So step 7, I always have problem with, because I don't understand what a shortcoming is. Still do this, and I try over. And every time my sponsor reminds me of it, but right now I don't remember it. So we're just going to keep on going. Step 8. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make an amends to them all. so the people that I did harm, and I couldn't see this until I made my step 4 inventory. I didn't see step 8 until, and I'm so glad that these steps are in a row, because when I had looked back and seen the harm that I had done to my mom, and in the beginning, I used to blame everything on my mom. I blamed my alcoholism, my addiction on my mom. I'm thinking, she's a horrible mother. You never saw that I was in a gang, and then I started using drugs, and I started drinking? Like, who does that? Who lets their kid do that? I blamed her for everything, and I'm like, I never accepted responsibility for any of that. And so when I took responsibility for that, I started to change things, and I looked at what was my part in that situation. And, you know, I had to make my list and start in step 9, make the direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So there was some people that I used to work for in a couple years ago in my addiction, and they asked me to run their business for them while I was in my alcoholism and addiction really bad. And they were never around, and I started stealing from them. And when I had to make this list and I had to go back and make an amends to them, I thought, they're going to have me arrested, and I'm going to be charged with, you know, embezzling. Like, I'm literally going to get in trouble for this. But that stealing from them helped me fuel my addiction even more. You know, on lunchtime, take money out of the petty cash. Let's go get a bottle of, you know, whatever, and let's get drunk. And that's what I did. And then I would just forward the phones to my cell phone. I could be drunk at the bar, answering the phone from the bar, you know. And what happened was, it was amazing, because I got a new job where I'm in retail, and my old bosses ended up coming in the front door, and I was terrified, and I was thinking, okay, I have 7 months, I have sobriety, what have I learned, what are my tools, what am I going to say to them? They came right up to me, and they were like, Rita, we've missed you, we love you, where have you been? And they were, that right there was, I saw the miracle, what they're talking about in the promises. That is the living amends. You know, one of these days, I don't know how I'll make it right with that situation, but I still have to do it somehow. But, you know, they come into my business. They come into the where I work at. They come in a lot, and I get to see them all the time, all their kids and their family. And, you know, and I was invited to a lot of their things at church, so I went with them as a family to there. I was really close, but I was so deep in my addiction that I felt really bad that I stole from them. But, you know, to this day, just staying sober and seeing them when they come in, and they just still love me to death. And you know, yeah. And then step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That step 10, 11, and 12, I think, are the ones that we do every day. You know, step 10, I know when something would happen to me, you know, I was already out of rehab when I did step 10. So just dealing with people in life's terms, and having friends, and just being out in society. And it was hard for me at first, because I isolated so much that I had a social anxiety when I came out. As soon as I got out of rehab, I went into the mall for something. I freaked out because I could not be around people. And it took me a while, but now I work in retail where I have to talk to people all day long, all, you know, and I love it. I absolutely love it. But what happened was, is when I first got out in the workforce, certain people would be rude to me, or they would, like, you know, talk to me rude or disrespectful, and I would take it personal. And then what I would do in return, I would snap back at them saying, don't you know who I am? I am nobody. But that's just my mentality. Don't you know who I am? I'm 6 months out of rehab. Don't you talk to me like that, you know? I don't know where I was at, but I just thought I was somebody. Yeah. And And I know I used to think, you know what? I'm a crazy person, because then I can go back out and I'll be crazy on you. But it wasn't worth doing that over anybody, you know? But I can see how that happens in recovery. Before the 8 different times that I had come into recovery, one little person would get upset at me, or somebody would tell me off. I would turn around and say, screw you, I'm going back out. I would hurt myself in return for somebody's actions. That's how much power other people had over me. I had no self-esteem, and I was consumed with fear. Fear that I loved myself, that I was not worthy. That is another thing, is that my whole entire life, I did not know who I wanted to be or where. And I used to tell myself that, I was a piece of crap my whole entire life. But when I got to certain points in my life, and I started, certain points in my step work, my sponsor used to turn around and tell me, you're worthy of it. You are worthy of this. Why do you feel so that you're not worthy of any of this? And I just believe that God does not make junk. He doesn't. We're all here for a purpose. And I think the most intelligent people are in this room tonight. We just need to step out of our comfort zone and give this program a chance and experience something you will never experience. I just came from 2 years ago living in, out of my car and drinking and using every minute of the day. And then knowing that drinking and using did nothing for me anymore, because I was gone out of my mind. Every minute of the day I had to do something, because that's how powerful my alcoholism was. And you too can have sobriety just like me. I just cannot believe I have a little bit over 2 years. That's just amazing. And step 10 is, before your head hits the pillow at night, take a personal inventory of what your day was like. When I had a couple months, I got into an argument with some girl, and the next day I had to, it ate me up so bad, I couldn't even go to sleep that night. So the next day I had to seek this girl out and go find her and say, you know what? I was wrong. That whole situation, I was being either egotistic or prideful, and I should have handled that situation way better. I took responsibility for my own actions. If she didn't accept it, I don't even care. That's not her. That's not my problem. I don't have to worry about that. I have to worry about what was my part in that situation. And after I did that with that girl, I felt like just a weight coming off my shoulders. And I was like, is this all we have to do? Is what this program is based on? It's amazing. It makes me feel so good inside. I feel that channel to my higher power is connected so powerful now. And I feel my spirit has been healed just by doing these steps. And step 11 is so important to me. Prayer and meditation. Every morning I wake up with my 24-hour book, my little black book, and another devotional book. And I sit there and I read. Books have been a very big instrumental in my recovery. I love to read, and it's helped me through a lot. So that and going to AA meetings is just a very big part of my recovery. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening at the result of these steps and carried this message to other suffering alcoholics. And what I do today is, I joke about it because I'm not in a relationship and I don't want to be today. Before, I would jump into the next relationship as soon as possible because I didn't know who I was and I didn't like myself being single. Since I've been married for almost half of my lifetime, I thought being married made me who I was. Like, I was born to be married. It didn't matter who I was married to. I just needed to be married. And I had to have a man in my life because I was afraid to be by myself. There goes that fear base again of the fear of the unknown. And today, I know that my higher power will have somebody out there special for me, and it's on his time, not my time, because I can't force it. So we do a lot of step works on relationships. And I was joking the other day. I was telling everybody that I joined Match.com, and my ex, and they tell you on there what you want in a man. I go, my expectations are so high. There's only 2 available men in Tulare County for me. And I don't want them. So I just continued that. But it's just funny. I think it is. But what I do today is I carry the message to the next suffering alcoholic. I love to tell my story. I'm excited to meet new women. When new women come into the program, I love to give back at New Visions as my stomping grounds, because without New Visions and the people that used to come in there and help us, you know, I would not be here today. So I give back, and I love the women there. You know, all we have to do is give that little glimmer of hope, and, you know, and you too can be up here with 2 years of sobriety. And, you know, I get to see the light come on in my sponsee's eyes. And I told him, if you could just hold on, if we can just get through these steps, you will have a new life, and you'll never know your potential. And the thing is, what gives them the most fear in their life is the fear of the unknown and the fear of failure. Everybody in their alcoholism and addiction is so used to failure, they don't even know what it is to be successful. I don't know if any of you, I've never been around a healthy relationship in my life, so I don't know what a healthy husband and wife portrays. I've never known that. I've never seen that. So, you know, when my brother got a couple years of sobriety and I was still out there, I was totally jealous of him. It ate me up. I used to see them on Facebook at the lake doing going skiing and doing all things. And they're all, Rita, come on, let's go. Let's do this. And I'm like, I can't. I'm stuck. And I couldn't get out of there. And, Okay. Well, anyways, I finished my steps, and I'm so glad, because I did not know it was 8 o'clock. Thank you.